This is Jones and Keefe
on WEEI and streaming everywhere on the Odyssey app.
Back here on WEEI, it's Christmas Eve version of Jones and Keefe. I'm John Lyons alongside Dan Ball. And we've been talking a lot of Patriots today. We did start off with the Celtics. We are going to get to the Bruins later. They had their best win of the season last night. We'll touch on the Red Sox a little bit. Just finished our Tier Tuesday, which we might review later on. But right now, we're going to continue talking Patriots with the one and only Tom E. Curran of NBC Sports Boston. Tom joins the show every week on Jones and Keefe, but he usually does not have the honor of speaking to myself and Dan Ball, right? I'm sure he's rolling his eyes on the phone now, but Tom, thanks for joining us and taking the time. Good morning.
What's up, John? How you doing, Dan? Thanks for having me. Merry Christmas.
Hey, Merry Christmas, to you. And I want to start off with this loss to the Buffalo Bills, Tom. We've been taking a lot of calls today, talking to a lot of people who feel that even though the Patriots lost that game, the fact that it was a close loss was a check in Gerard Mayo's column to staying around for next year. Do you think that's the case, or do you think it didn't even rise to the level that his job was really in jeopardy in the first place?
I agree with the latter point more, but I do think it was by far the best game that they've played, believe it or not, or the most you could draw the most from this since probably the opening game of the season in terms of things to feel okay about. You know, I think that we could all agree that the second half was almost inevitable. We did a halftime live on NBC Sports Boston. I said, you know, the final score is probably going to be 28-24 Buffalo. And I think we could all agree that eventually Buffalo's talent would win out. But I think the circumstances of the game, given how poorly they performed in Arizona, really flatlining, and the mistakes that they made with penalties, with breakdowns. We still saw some of those against Buffalo, especially with the long run. But I just think the climate around the team and in the week leading up to the Buffalo game and going against a team that had scored 90 points in the previous 2 weeks to show signs of life defensively, to confuse the MVP front runner in Josh Allen, to perform well enough offensively to show some more aggressiveness in different junctures. I think all that's true. As far as the fact that Gerard Mayo was on the hot seat, it's interesting. I kind of feel as if that was a media creation based upon, hey, is Mayo on the hot seat because of the results and where things have gone so far this season? But there was nothing really ever articulated by the Crafts that they expected anything more than they were getting. So, but once he spoke after the Arizona game, I think that ready-made, custom-made hot seat he was kind of placed in, and that's not inaccurate. I think that was such a discouraging performance that it really changed the landscape, and I think the Bills game changed it back a bit.
Tom, with the understanding that Gerard Mayo's seat may not be hot at all, would you extend the same thing to the two coordinators where they should also be off the hot seat in our eyes?
I wouldn't. You know, they have to scrutinize so much of the coaching staff, I think, because it's not just, hey, everybody's new. There's no development with so many different positions. You know, again, we can be cowed by the fact that Marte Mapu had a really, really good game, for instance, but he was a healthy scratch the week before. Jalen Polk was, I think, trending toward being a healthy scratch before Jabril Peppers was unable to go. Javon Baker is still catchless on the season. So these are positions and these are sides of the ball that really deserve a lot of scrutiny going forward. The defense in DeMarcus Covington was hamstrung by the injuries primarily to Bentley, absence of Peppers, the one to Barmore. But I still look at that group and say it should not have declined as poorly as it did, even though they had the brain drain of losing Steve Belichick, losing Mayo's full-time attention, losing Bill Belichick as an overseer of the defense. The development still was not certainly what you're looking for. And then offensively, I just think there seems to be a disconnect. To me, it was eye-opening last week to hear Alex Van Pelt saying, I just don't want to run Drake May. And the Patriots, whether it be Mayo, May or Jonathan Kraft shaking his head in the box, certainly are registering a level of dissatisfaction with where the offense is, despite the development of May.
So, Tom, to build off that, you mentioned Alex Van Pelt. I mean, he, I think, was largely an Elliott Wolf guy from previous time in Cleveland, and the roster is Elliott Wolf's purview. When you look at the uncertainty, per se, around Van Pelt, around some of the additions that have been brought in, you mentioned Javon Baker and Jalen Polk's been a big disappointment. Do you look at Elliott Wolf and say, hey, there might be an issue there? Or do you look at it and say, hey, he inherited a really poor roster and this is going to take multiple years for this to really get better?
No, I think that he should absolutely be scrutinized probably more than anyone else in terms of guys who were elevated this offseason, Mayo included. I mean, he was part of the player procurement along with Matt Groh when Bill was here. And we can still say, all right, well, Bill was the final say. But there was so much made in 2021 about the collaboration that was going on in that draft. There was in the 2022 draft, it basically whiffed on virtually every player in that draft. And the last two drafts, they haven't yielded very much. So to me, Elliott Wolf, between the free agent signings, you got Hooper and Antonio Gibson as the height of success. You got Chukwuma Okorafor, you got KJ Osborne. I'm probably missing other individuals right now as well. And you just have to look at it and say, what exactly are they looking at in terms of projections for what guys are going to do? Because I'm not seeing identities that are laid out. When this player gets here, we're going to do X, Y, or Z with him, and this is his plan to succeed.
Tom, to stick on the offense for a moment, specific to the quarterback, how would you describe the place in development where Drake May is, both in the physical talent throwing the football, but also in his decision-making after a couple of plays from Sunday's game he may want to have back?
Yeah, it's really a great discussion because we got into a spirited one after the game where Michael Hawley said, well, why is Drake May given so much latitude and let off the hook so frequently in his first year when he makes mistakes, and Jerod Mayo isn't? And to that I would say, you got a guy who's had seven consecutive games with turnovers. And you can say, okay, well, the Kayshon Booty interception last week, he basically lateraled it to a cornerback. But there are myriad bad decisions mixed in there. I think it's a growing pain type of situation. He's 14 touchdowns and 10 picks. He does so many demonstrably good things on a week-to-week basis that if he wasn't out there, they'd have no shot of being competitive in these games, that it's easier to excuse those. I think he has exceeded fairly high expectations. And Mayo coming in, I think the people were skeptical about his performance and his readiness for the job. And I think that he is about met that level of expectation. So as a result, that's what my answer was. Why does May get so much more latitude? I think it's because you understand that a 22-year-old first-year quarterback with 25 college starts is probably going to throw it to the other team occasionally, and he has done that.
So, Tom, I want to follow up off that because I think the biggest issue the Patriots offense has had is probably their offensive line and protection, but the next biggest is turnovers, right? They're -9 turnover differentials, 27th in the league. If they didn't turn the ball over against Buffalo, or even if they once instead of three times, maybe they even win that game. And I take your point on May being young and growing pains, but beyond May, whether it's Stevenson fumbling, the receivers not hanging on to passes that lead to picks, is there anything that can be done in these last couple games or going forward even into 2025 to limit the amount of times this offense is turning the ball over? It's killing them week in and week out. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's anything that can be done besides just get new players to limit that.
I mean, Stevenson is a tremendous player. I just think it's a focus issue with him on occasion. That fumble was not off a tremendous hit. And on the next time he was in the open field, he again had it away from his body. You know, they have this saying, as you guys probably know, 5 points of contact. There's five different places that you should be contacting the football between your hand, your forearm, your bicep, your chest, whatever else is involved in there. And he's not running like that. And to me, I think that's a focus thing. He knows he ought to. He's a very productive player. He looked like Earl friggin' Campbell when he took it in on that drop down or the run for his touchdown against Buffalo. So to me, it's details. It's guys perhaps trying to do too much on different occasions or losing focus. And I think it kind of goes back to the previous coach. Do your job. If your job is to carry the football and make sure that you end the game, end the play with the ball in your hands, well, that's what you're looking for.
Tom, on the offense as well, from a wide receiving perspective, there's kind of a lot of spare parts that have been put together either through the draft or free agency. Are there guys on that wide receiving unit that you see as long-term pieces, and how drastic could the change at that position look like this offseason?
I think DeMario Douglas is definitely a long-term piece. I think Bourne will probably be back for another year. There's relevance there. And I think Kayshon Boutte is, you know, a productive enough receiver. Certainly, we've seen that, and I thought that he was, and I thought that he was last year, too. He's got tremendous body control, excellent hands. He was in the doghouse last year, and he's emerged as a guy who is fairly dependable. He's a three receiver. At best, a two if he continues on an upward arc. But to me, Jalen Polk has to be on an extremely short leash going into 2025. Jeez, going back in time. Because you're looking at a player who has done nothing. It's not a redshirt year. It's your rookie year. You're a second-round pick. You played a lot at a successful college. People thought highly of you. And you've done absolutely nothing for 5 months to improve. So if you have to say you go the Duke Dawson direction with someone like him, or Cyrus Jones, said, look, it's just not working, we're moving on, then you have to move on and get better at that position. What's so hard about getting better at that position is, whether it's draft or free agency, it's really hard to extract good players from the wide receiver position in free agency. Even if T. Higgins hits the market, which he may not even do, he's still going to be so expensive. Is he going to be a $35 million a year player? Is he worth that? Or you just say, we got to pay the price, we stink, so we have to get wide receivers in here. My feeling is the best way to find a wide receiver is via trade. And we've seen that work in different places. So that's where Elliott Wolf has to be innovative. I think the best players who we project as free agents generally re-sign with their teams. So the Patriots have to create something in that market.
He is Tom E. Curran of NBC Sports Boston. Tom, really appreciate you taking the time on this Christmas Eve, and have a great holiday and rest of the week.
Thank you so much, guys. Take care.
All right, Dan, a lot to get to there. Some interesting answers. That receiver room, the trade thing, I agree, and I've been saying that for a while. I think that second-round pick the Patriots have, whether it's 33, 34, 35, whatever it lands, that's going to be the pick they trade for a veteran wide receiver. Don't sleep on it being DK Metcalf either.
So,
little side take. But we're going to get to that and more coming up next. First, though, we have to trend with Zach Coe.
The exclusive home for Patriots Monday and Friday.
Now, here's what's trending on WEEI.
Trending now, brought to you by Harry Potter, the exhibition. The Bruins head into the NHL holiday break on a high note, getting a 4-1 victory over one of the best teams in the NHL, the Washington Capitals. Justin Brazeau, Elias Lindholm, Charlie Coyle, and Brad Marchand, the goal scorers for the Bees. They'll be off until Saturday when they head to Columbus to take on the Blue Jackets. Tough one for the Celtics last night. They fell to the Orlando Magic, 108-104, the final from Orlando. Jaylen Brown led the way for the Seas with 35 points after Jason Tatum was a late scratch from the game. They have a quick bounce back, looking to get a win over the Philadelphia 76ers tomorrow night at the Garden. Tip-off at 5 p.m. Patriots continue to prep for Saturday's matchup at Gillette with the Chargers. That one goes down Saturday afternoon, kickoff set for 1 o'clock. Still no injury report from the Patriots, but we'll have that for you whenever it is released. NFL Week 17 kicking off tomorrow with the Chiefs traveling to Pittsburgh to take on the Steelers at 1. Then Lamar Jackson and the Ravens head to Houston for a matchup with the Texans. That one goes down at 4:30. Don't forget you can hear Westwood One's coverage of both of those games right here on WEEI, coverage starting at 12:30 tomorrow afternoon. Red Sox continue to bolster their rotation yesterday as they reportedly agreed to a one-year $20 million deal with former Dodger Walker Buehler. According to Alex Speer, the Sox now turn their attention to adding a right-handed bat to the lineup. Harry Potter the Exhibition has just added dates in Boston. Come celebrate the filmmaking magic of Harry Potter in an unforgettable, interactive way. You won't want to miss it. Here through April 27th. Get your tickets before it's too late at HarryPotterTheExhibition.com. My name is Zach Coe, and that's what's trending on WEEI and WEEI.com. More Jones and Keefe coming up after this.
of Jones and Keefe
on WEEI.
Just keep this playing, Zach. It'll be a music station for a segment.
Now we're really getting
into the classics. That is the holiday classic, Dominic the Italian Christmas Donkey. I'm John Lyons. Alongside Dan Ball, with Zach co-producing, Brian running the Twitch as well. Big thank you to Tommy Curran for joining us last segment. Some really good insight from Tom that we're going to react to in a few minutes here. But we do have a bunch of text messages that came in. Again, if you want to join the show, 617-779-7937. That is the call-in line and the text line if you want to join us. Zach, what do you got for us on the text line?
Yeah, one texter is very enthusiastic about this take because he's given it a whole bunch of times on here. The best coaching change they could make would be Vrabel, McDaniels, and Brian Flores. Gas up the duck boats.
Yeah, so look, my number one choice to replace Belichick when they got rid of him was Brian Flores. I just don't think he's not going to leave Minnesota to be a DC somewhere else. He's going to have to be a head coach somewhere.
Would you have that conversation now?
If and look, and that is... It's funny. That's not even an anti-Mayo thing. It's just I'm such a believer in Brian Flores that if he was willing to be the Patriots head coach, I would make that switch. I would. I think he's that good. He got screwed in Miami. I mean, back-to-back winning seasons, and they fired him anyway because he didn't want to tamper with Tom Brady and do something against the rules. So I'm a big Brian Flores believer. I would make that switch. I'd consider making that switch for Mike Vrabel. But similar to the Alex Van Pelt thing, like, I would swap out Van Pelt if it was McDaniels, Dabel, or Lincoln Riley. That's the only way I'm doing it. Probably only moving on from Mayo if I know I can get Brian Flores.
And the entire conversation comes within the context of, is somebody going to come and take one of those, for sake of conversation, one of those coordinator positions if they know they're coaching under Jerod Mayo, who was already coming off of a 3-win season?
And that's a tough part, because if you're someone, like, let's just say Josh McDaniels or Dabel, all right, if I go be OC of the Patriots and they stink again and they fire Mayo, like, do I get promoted to be head coach or am I out too? And it's really it's one
and
way or the other.
It's a good thing, because if you're going to get fired, then you don't want the job. But if you're going to get promoted, are you really going to work in symbiosis with Jerod Mayo, knowing that you're a heartbeat away from the head coaching position?
Yeah, it's a fair point. So, like, I think that's, again, that would be a great pipe dream for Vrabel, Flores, McDaniels. I don't think Brian Flores is taking a DC job anywhere. He's going to stay in Minnesota until he becomes a head coach, and he should be a head coach very soon. Mike Vrabel, by the way, don't sleep on Ohio State. If they don't make the college football national championship game, and I know it's not really fair to Ryan Day, who's like 60-4 or 60-10, but four of those losses are to Michigan, and he's got a 500 record in the college football playoff. And I bring all that up to say I think Vrabel would take that job.
Yeah.
And I think he would be the head coach of Ohio State. I think he would do well there. So that's why, again, I just don't see that as realistic. That's all.
There's already a precedent of good coaches with New England ties going to the college route. That's a prestigious.
Imagine Belichick at UNC, by the way. I just, you know what I'm waiting for?
Yeah.
Is like he's in a press conference and someone asks about an injury and he goes, yeah, I don't work in the medical school. I'm not a med student. You know, something like that. Yeah, we're on to Wake Forest.
I just can't wait. I was thinking about this the entire time when they were announcing him and it became a reality that he was going to coach at UNC. I'm young enough where I'm a couple years removed from being student media and going to Quinnipiac, being in the media room for, you know, a Quinnipiac hockey game. Can you imagine the poor student media reporter? Notebook just shaking. I got to go ask Bill Belichick a question after they just got blown out by some other Power Five team. And you got to go in and ask him what went wrong. That makes me laugh.
I could just see him like with a transfer portal kid, like, yeah, look, we could use you. We could find, but we don't really need you. I mean, I'm going to Chapel Hill High School later today. I'll find a kid there. That's going to be fun. But I bring all that up to say the people that want Vrabel, he's going to be the number one name, arguably, in demand at both the professional and college level for a head coach. So I just don't think it's going to be that realistic. I just don't. Zach, what else do you got for us?
Speaking of Josh McDaniels, another texter is not a very big fan of his. He runs a complicated, antiquated offense. Brady was the only one it worked with. He's not a mobile quarterback. He's a smart pocket passer. We need to cater to Drake May's strengths.
Yeah, well, he did have top 10 points per game offenses with Matt Castle and Mac Jones, so that kind of worked with them too. And I've written like 1,500-word articles about why Josh McDaniels is good. I will not read them all right now on air. I think the important thing to remember is how well he can adjust, how well he manages the clock, how well he schemes things up, excuse me. A lot of people miss Josh McDaniels that wanted him out of town a few years ago.
Right. No, that's a good point, and I do wonder. I know that he was essentially the head coach of the offense. I wonder in a modern day offense without Bill Belichick as the head coach, you have to wonder what the fit is. But again, if you're going to keep on the same path of we want players and coaches that have ties to this dynastic run of the Patriots, then I understand why you would be calling Josh McDaniels.
Zach, can we get one more?
Yeah, a lot of calls for Elliot Wolf's head. A lot of people don't think he is a very good talent evaluator and drafter, and obviously that's going to be the most important thing coming up here for the Pats.
Yeah, we did not include him in Tier Tuesday, which we're going to review later on. He might be a Tier 3 guy of the last 12 months in Boston sports.
I think he has to be. Look at the dividends that it's paid. On top of the fact that he's been involved in years past to build up this crap roster, to then get control of the roster and build the crap roster.
So we had Tommy Curran on last segment. If you missed any of it, the Odyssey app is free, Apple Podcasts. Wherever you get your WEEI, your sports talk, you can find it. He talked about trading for a wide receiver, though, is the key to this. And I think he's right, because T. Higgins is a good player, and I would pay T. Higgins. But I think if you look at the trade market, some of the guys that could be out there, it's a higher quality of player with already agreed to contracts than what you would get in T. Higgins.
Yeah, this is going to sound very negative, but if you trade for a wide receiver, that wide receiver has to play for the Patriots. They don't have another choice because of their contract.
Yeah, T. Higgins can say, I'm all set, whatever.
And the reason I bring that up is because this was proven last offseason with Calvin Ridley. I don't know that high-end free agent wide receivers are jumping at the opportunity to play in New England.
Even
however,
Ayuk as well.
Right. And all that to say, I think that Drake May's performance should turn some heads. I think it moves the Patriots stock up as a destination and in a place where you can be a number one with a true starting quarterback that's shown some elite potential and that is clearly on the rise. I think that's important, but of all of the options that you'll have to be a number one wide receiver, there are a lot of teams that need bona fide number one receivers in this league. I still don't know how high the Patriots rank. So the trade route, they don't have another choice. They have to play for New England.
And my thing on the receiver position is I lean so much more towards established vets than I do rookies and draft picks. And look, I know you can say like Rome Odunze last year for Chicago or Brian Thomas, great players. I think Thomas is going to be a legit superstar in the NFL. He's already a star.
Yeah.
But you're not going to be drafting that guy in the first round. You need a left tackle so badly if you're the Patriots. I think you go tackle in round one. So by the time you get to your next pick, I don't know if that quality of rookie receiver is there. So if you could trade for a Metcalf, even a Deebo Samuel, who's having a down year, and I'm a little concerned about Deebo Samuel, but if you can trade for a guy like Metcalf or someone of that caliber, I think you're better off than trying to take a receiver again in the first couple rounds of the draft.
And to your point about the draft, even if you are in a position where you can take a wide receiver, am I going to trust Elliot Wolf and Matt Groh to pick the wide receiver that's going to fit the mold?
Let's build off that, right? Like Matt Groh was here when they drafted N'Keal Harry. And from what I heard and people I talked to in the organization, the scouts liked A.J. Brown and Deebo Samuel better and Bill overruled them. So we don't know where Matt Groh fell in that debate. But 2022... Groh and Elliot Wolf were both here. They went with Tyquan Thorne. And I know Bill's ultimately responsible. Tommy Curran said that to us, right? We all know that. But they were there. And Matt Groh gets promoted to that director of whatever it was, scouting, player personnel role. All of a sudden, your draft is based almost solely on relative athletic score, and you take Tyquan Thorne over George Pickens. He's still here. Elliot Wolf is still here, who just took Jalen Polk instead of Ladd McConkey,
right,
or even a tackle in that spot in round two. He took Javon Baker, who, he said some cool things when he got drafted. he had some cool things in training camp, but he's had no impact, right? He got benched on kickoff return, right? Do you trust them to take a guy at the top of the second round that's going to be an instant impact player? Like, I just don't know that I do. I'd much rather have the veteran guy, whether it's T. Higgins or a trade candidate guy that we know. Hey, he's done it in this league. DK Metcalf has been an all-pro level receiver in this league. Deebo Samuel's been a legit weapon in this league. Someone just texted in Jordan Addison.
Yeah.
I don't think the Vikings would trade him.
Yeah.
But at least you know with Jordan Addison, he's made legit plays in this league.
Right.
Like, if the Jets want to tear it all down and they want to move on from Davante Adams or even, dare I say, Garrett Wilson, those are good players that you know have done it in the league. I would so much rather trade for a guy like that, much like, by the way, the Bills did with a young Josh Allen when they brought in Stephon Diggs. I'd much rather that than say, hey, let's take another guy in the second round or even the first round, which I think would be a reach, and hope he pairs well with Douglas and Polk for years to come.
Yeah, because at this point with where Drake May is in his development, it's beyond crucial. You have to find a number one for this quarterback, because there's such a direct correlation between young and up-and-coming quarterbacks that succeed in this league and having a true number one receiver for them to throw to.
And I think, to be clear, and I don't know how you feel about this, the tackle and the offensive line is the more important thing, because you can have all the receivers you want. If you can't protect and your quarterback's getting smoked all the time, he's still not going to be as successful as he could be. Even look at the Bengals. They made it all the way to the Super Bowl with Burrow and Chase, and then Burrow got sacked 8 times in the Super Bowl, and they really haven't fully recovered from that, right? They lost the Super Bowl. Maybe they'll make the playoffs this year, and they're good, don't get me wrong. But I think you need to have the protection first. But to your point, you need to have someone in the pass game that defenses have to worry about. I mean, right now, is there anyone, Dan, in the pass game for the Patriots that a defensive coordinator actually has to game plan against?
No. And the clearer example was that Buffalo was playing single high safety in man, and they were just kind of providing normal blasé coverage, and after two scores, the Patriots couldn't really generate anything. So the answer is no, and though I agree, and I think building in the trenches on both sides of the ball is the first step on building a consistent champion, and I think you see that with a lot of the best teams in the league, I think you failed your team and you failed your quarterback if you come out of your offseason and you haven't addressed both.
And considering the money they have and the draft capital they're going to have, they should address both.
No reason
like,
you shouldn't,
they should
absolutely
walk out of this offseason with a bona fide guy in the passing game defenses have to worry about, and they need to walk out of this offseason with at least two new starting offensive linemen. And you look at the draft picks they have, the money to spend, and the guys available. Right, like, let's not forget, at the tackle position, Ronnie Stanley's going to be a free agent, too. So, like, the guys available via trade, via free agency, via the draft, you should walk out of this offseason with an answer at both of those things. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to walk out of here with elite players across the board and suddenly you're 11-6 football team. But those two areas, those glaring needs that you've had for the last 3 years, you should be able to address them this offseason.
Yeah, I don't need elite players, especially on the offensive line. The bar is so low where I don't need elite players at all five spots. I need NFL caliber players.
Which they don't have at left tackle. They don't have at left guard. Right now they don't have at center. No disrespect to Ben Brown coming in trying hard, but they just they don't have that stuff at three of their offensive line spots.
Right.
Maybe and even four.
The fact that Drake May isn't dead because of that. Same with Jacoby Brissett. Is a borderline miracle, but you hit on something important. There are two different ways that you can do this at the same time. High money short term for a veteran in one of those positions, and then in your third, your fourth, your fifth, that's where you draft and develop your offensive linemen as second stringers, so eventually if you have something, they can work their way into the starting lineup, and God forbid if you have injuries, which every team in football is going to have on their O-line, you have a second wave that you can go to, so you're not screwed with one injury. It's a lot of work, and it goes back to the question that's been asked and I think answered by a lot of our texters, which is, do you trust Elliott Wolf and Matt Groh to do it? The answer can't be yes yet because there isn't a sample size for it, but there is a path forward with the assets that you have to address both of those and be a much more complete offense.
And I think these two positions lead into the turnover. So, like, we've talked a lot about, you know, Stevenson and all his fumbles, May and all his interceptions. When you have receivers that can't get open, it makes throwing the ball down the field a lot harder.
Yep.
Maybe you're more prone to interceptions. When you have linemen that can't protect, you have more strip sacks, you have tougher yards for a running back, you have less protection to try to get the ball out, which I mentioned the strip sacks, but also less time for the receivers to get open. Like, if you improve those areas, not only are you obviously going to be better, but it might help correct one of your key flaws, which is all the turnovers you've had that have cost you games. Like, I think back to that Drake May end zone interception, which was a bad throw by May and I thought a bad decision. If you have a number one guy in the pass game, is that happening? Like maybe he's making a different decision. Maybe he can put it up and that guy can make a play. But you don't have, I mean, the last time they had a guy in the pass game, teams truly had to game plan around was probably Rob Gronkowski in 2018. Maybe you want to say James White and Julian Edelman in 2019. I'll give you that. But Rob Gronkowski was probably the last true guy they had that teams are like, oh my God, we have to stop that guy.
Right.
They don't have a, I mean, again, Hunter Henry's a good player. DeMario Douglas, I like the player. There's a lot to like. But our defensive coordinator's sitting there saying, man, we have to stop that guy. Our defensive coordinator's sitting there and saying, man, we can't rush the left tackle because he'll stonewall us every time. Or we can't rush at the left guard because he'll stonewall us every time. They don't have those guys that defensive coordinators look at and say, man, we really have to figure this out. We really have to adjust to these guys.
And I'm not saying that this player was ever going to be good enough to build around as your franchise quarterback, but you went through an entire tenure with Mac Jones as your quarterback and really did nothing of significance to try to help that guy out. In fact,
you were a detriment to him with your OC situation in 2022.
Yeah, exactly. So you gave him no weapons. You did not give him consistent protection. And you also gave him a defensive coach as his offensive coordinator. So I would hope you can look at the recent history and go, geez, we made three or four significant mistakes in terms of this guy's development. We have another player that I think clearly has more upside in Drake May. We cannot afford to make these mistakes and be conservative or be wrong with the way that we build it. And one more thing that I think it you improve the offense with, the protection that you get with a better offensive line and more weapons, it allows Alex Van Pelt to expand his play calling.
Right,
tenfold.
That's a good point.
And now, granted, is he capable of expanding it? We had a text in a couple times about playing with pace and tempo and motion offense and pre-snap motion and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if AVP is capable of calling a game at that level that really adds in the Detroit-esque wrinkles that you see on truly elite offenses in the league, but it at least gives you the opportunity to try, because I really think your offensive coordinator is severely hampered with the kind of players you have around the quarterback right now.
Yeah, it's almost that chicken and egg discussion. Like, is your OC not scheming guys open, or is he so worried about your offensive line situation he can't call certain things? And I think that's true. I think there's certain concepts they have to stay away from because they have no faith in their protection. They have no faith in guys to get open. I just think, and you could sit here and say it's Josh McDaniels or Lincoln Riley as OC, and I think they'd be better, but they would have to stay away from certain things with some of the guys they have. I mean, look at Josh McDaniels had to call things differently with Cam Newton because he couldn't throw. Like, and I know that's an extreme example, but he had to stay away from certain things because of that. After week two, Cam Newton really couldn't throw much the rest of the year.
Right.
So I think it's a concern. I think it's something if I'm Elliott Wolf, I look at what happened, especially Sunday against Buffalo, a game you could have won if you had one guy in the pass game for them to game plan around, or you didn't turn the ball over, you had a little bit better protection, it's there. Like, you can do it. I just don't know. I think the people have some fair concerns about their faith in Elliott Wolf. We've talked a bunch of Patriots today, Dan Ball, but you and I are also hockey guys, and the Bruins had, I think, their best win of the season last night against Washington. We are going to... It'd be nice if I could talk on talk radio here.
Yeah,
we are going to get into that. Coming up next, 617-779-7937. It's Lions and Ball in for Jones and Keefe here on WEEI.
Jones and Keefe.
Jones and Keefe.
On WEEI.
As Bing Crosby liked to say, there is no place like home for the holidays. Bruins win. They've won five consecutive games at TD Garden.
Back here on WEEI, it's Jones and Keefe. And PSC 888 in the Twitch chat says, who are these guys? It's John Lyons and Dan Ball. That's who it is.
It's a fair question.
Yeah. I don't even know who I am half the time.
It's very philosophical of you.
Right. So we've talked a lot about Patriots and Mayo and all that stuff today. We might hit on it a little bit later. We, of course, opened the show with Celtics. We do have a little bit of Red Sox to still get to. But Dan, last night, I would say probably the Bruins' best win of the entire season. They beat the Capitals 4-1, hold Washington to 11 shots on goal. After this game, Washington 23-9-2. So this is one of the best teams in the NHL. And it felt like for most of this game, the Bruins were not just good, they were dominant over this Washington team. I thought it was a really encouraging sign heading into their holiday Christmas break.
Yeah, no question, because they didn't fold despite the fact that they weren't necessarily getting the bounces and scoring. That's easily a game where you can give up a and we've seen this in the past this season where Jeremy Swayman gives up a backbreaker, especially when you see the shot discrepancy yeah.
And
that
I would
we
even
saw.
Say the one goal the Capitals scored to make it 1-1
yeah.
was on their fourth shot of the game.
Right, exactly.
So you sit there and you're like, uh-oh, is this going to be downhill? You know, is this because you've held them to three shots, they score on the fourth one, but they held them down after that, and they added three more of their own.
And there, the context of this game was really impressive, too. You lost David Pastrnak during the game with an upper body injury. I don't know if you saw Brad Marchand's comment in the locker room after, but he was asked how David Pastrnak looked, and he described how he looked after the game in a very colorful way. But so you lost him, and then Oliver Wahlstrom got five in a game for a hit from behind midway through the game. So you were down to 10 forwards and down two of your four right-hand, or, you know, right wingers. So to be able to score three in the third on a pretty stingy defense and goaltending unit in Washington and finally have the dam break in your direction as opposed to give up a backbreaker and then kind of fold, which is something that we've seen in certain spots when this team has been struggling, I was really impressed. And don't look now, but the Bruins are up to 11-4-1 under Joe Sakho, third place, four out of first in their division right now. So you're starting to see that old school spark and energy from this Bruins group, despite the fact that you and I said during our tiers, Don Sweeney hasn't constructed the best roster, and far from it.
Yeah.
They're starting to show some energy that we would expect from a Bruins
team. You and I and many were very critical of Jeremy Swayman to start this year because he was awful.
Yeah.
And right now, look, he's still 44th in goals against average, 47th in save percentage, but
yikes, jeez.
Has he turned a little bit of a corner this month? Now, yeah, the 8-1 blowout drubbing to Winnipeg, but other than that, he gives up two goals to Chicago, they stink, three goals to Philly, they stink, but then only one goal allowed to Vancouver. Edmonton, you lose in overtime, but only three goals, two in regulation. Then Washington, I know it's only 11 shots, but still only one goal given up, which was, I think, a power play goal. It was a snipe,
yeah.
That goal, though. I think it was a one-timer power play goal. Do you feel like he's back on track at all here, or is this still a, man, they're giving this guy $8.25 million a year?
I think two things can be true. I think it's certainly better, because he was unplayable at the beginning of the year.
Korpisalo was flat out better.
He was.
It wasn't even like,
not
hey,
a good thing.
We want to bench Swayman because of his attitude, his poor play, his contract, whatever reason. No, Korpisalo, opening night was a disaster, and after that, he was the better goalie on the team for the first 2 months of the season.
Yeah, and I think statistically he's still
ahead
is.
Of him in goals against average and save percentage. It's come closer,
yeah.
But he is still ahead of him.
He's on his way. And I maintain that we have to remember the proper context with Jeremy Swayman, where he has been a 50-50 split goalie with Linus Allmark for each of the last 2 years, give or take a few games. It is now his net and his net alone in Boston, and he has to live up to the contract and the fact that he is now truly the only long-term starting option for the Bruins moving forward. That's a completely different context than what we were looking at Jeremy Swayman at in years past, and we don't know if he can live up to that kind of expectation yet.
We have Zach Coe, our producer, with us, big Bruins guy. Did a lot of Bruins post-game with me in the playoffs. So, Zach, I mean, I think this is the Bruins' best win of the year. Are you on that train, or, I mean, where are you at?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think they have a great record under Sakho, but I think the biggest problem was that they weren't beating other playoff teams. They were kind of beating the teams that they were supposed to be beating. This is a win against, I think they're now the number three team points-wise in the entire league, so it's a really encouraging step forward to, like you said, not only look good, but look dominant for most of the game without Pastrnak.
And I think another thing, and this is a really low bar, which kind of sucks, but it's been two full weeks since they played a horrible game. Because under Montgomery, I mean, we talked about this, they were having a blowout loss basically once a week or so. I mean, remember the 4-0 loss down in Nashville to a team that hadn't won a game yet? You had the 8-2 loss to Carolina. There was 5-2 to Dallas before that. Toronto, of course, Montgomery's last game was the 5-1 loss, which came right after they lost 7-2 to Dallas. Now, like, they lost 8-1 to Winnipeg, but that was 2 weeks ago. So, again, it's a really low bar, and it sucks that that's the bar I'm looking at. But still, I mean, it was once a week they were getting blown out. Now it's, hey, been 2 weeks since they really got blown out. I mean, this is a team before the year, and maybe I was naive, I thought could have gone to the conference final with the talent they had, and considering they went to six games against Florida last year. I don't know if they're there right now, but they look a heck of a lot closer to that than they did a month ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you haven't really gotten a whole lot of out of Elias Lindholm to start the year, and he's finally starting to turn it on. The same.
Is it four goals Lindholm has so far this year or whatever? It might be three.
I think it's higher than that now because he scored a couple in those last couple games.
That's true. That's fair, yeah.
But guys like Lindholm, who obviously you had higher expectations for him given the contract that you gave him coming into the year, but even Charlie Coyle starting to play better. Trent Frederick, whose name has been in trade rumors a lot recently, he's starting to play a little bit better. So you're starting to get these depth guys going, and as we've seen in years past, when the Bruins are going to be successful, they're going to need these secondary scoring guys to put the puck in the back of the net because you can't just rely on Marchand and Pastrnak to do all your scoring.
Yeah, and I think the chief thing with Sacco is their defense has played a lot better, right? And I don't have the advanced analytic Corsi numbers in front of me, but their defense,
good,
just watch
keep them away.
Yeah, I know. I will. But their defense has played better, and yeah. I think that makes a difference because that was their failing 2 years ago against Florida in the first round. How many times could they not clear the puck out of their own zone, and it led to a goal? It was an issue last year against Florida. It was an issue earlier this year. They've been much better just getting the puck out of their own zone and away from the net. And I think that is much, I think even more so than Swayman improving, that's been the biggest difference since Sacco took over.
Here's your number, by the way. So after an 11-game goalless drought for Elias Lindholm, he's now scored in three of his last four games, up to six on the season. So not certainly,
I think
not
we
up
overrated
to what the contract
this guy
is
when they signed him.
Well,
unfortunately,
I think it's a classic free agency practice. It's I don't know. This is a bad example, but it's Louis Erickson of almost 10 years ago now.
Louis Erickson, but I can only speak for myself. But when they signed him, I'm like, oh, is this Bergeron light? He won 54% of his faceoffs. Can he score, you know, 20-25 goals? Be a great assist guy. And then you really peel it back. It's like, yeah, he had a 40-goal season playing with, what, Tkachuk and whoever. It was an all-star line.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I think we might have overrated this guy, and that's just who he's going to be. So that center's still a question there. And they're still, again, they've been better, but it still feels like Don Sweeney has work to do if this team's going to be a legit playoff contender. But best win of the season, I think, last night.
Let me put something out there real quick because I know we have to take a break. Chris Kreider. Healthy scratch
in
with the New York Rangers.
Yeah, I'm in.
You got to make the money work. He's got six and change for the next 3 years, so you probably have to get a third team there to take some of the salary cap in a deal. But if you can make that happen, round out the top six with him, go for it.
Yeah,
I'm all in.
Because that's
that
another
well.
Issue, right? They're a forward short in their top six.
They are. As we no disrespect to Morgan Geeky, but
he's not that guy.
No, he's not. Yeah. He's certainly not.
We got to get to I feel like we have to talk a little bit of Red Sox on the Red Sox flagship radio station. But yeah, they do sign Walker Buehler yesterday. On one hand, I'm glad they brought in a guy that won a World Series. On another hand, have they really spent a lot of money this offseason, even though we heard for months they were going to? The answer is no, and I'm a little concerned about that and them going forward. So it's John Lyons with Dan Ball. We're going to talk a little Red Sox coming up next here on WEEI.